This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to the Friday Pitch-In. Coming up, we'll hear more about the downfall of Indianapolis trucking giant Celadon and an offer to help their former employees navigate the holidays financially. And later, dockless electric scooters and the injuries they can cause, according to a new IU medical school study. But first, probably my favorite part of the week, a look at the state's headlines with our news queen. That's queen with a KW, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
How's it going? I've never been referred to as a news queen by anybody other than the amazing Maggie.
So what's going on this week? There have been some legislative priorities that we've heard about.
Yeah.
Specifically from the governor, I guess.
Yes. The governor laid out his 2020 legislative priorities on, oh, wow, time has no meaning. Tuesday, probably.
It's been a long week. A lot's happened.
It's been a 15-day week. And he highlighted a handful of topics. First and foremost, being raising the tobacco age to 21. Health groups in the Indiana Chamber of Commerce have really long pushed to raise the legal smoking age to 21 with no success. But this year, Holcomb said during his announcement in Terre Haute that the youth vaping increase has really convinced him to push it this year. And that isn't happening in a silo. A few weeks ago, House Speaker Brian Bosma announced he would also be pushing for that legislation to move forward. And he pointed to veterans groups spurring him to change his mind. So that's a big headline for that. That has been a long push of a lot of health advocates.
Good to know that the governor is down with that before the House moves on it. And so we know that it'll probably pass next year, it seems like.
Yeah. And him putting his weight behind that really does kind of elevate it that the Republican caucus is all on the same page. He's also pushing a little bit of interesting stuff, talking about hands-free driving. So this summer, there was a study committee to explore legalizing speed cameras in highway construction zones. Now, Holcomb did not say whether or not he would be open to that, but he did say he wants to ban Hoosier motorists from using their cell phones while driving unless they're hands-free. So in the state of Indiana, it is illegal to text while driving, but it's largely unenforceable because there are so many things you can do with a cell phone that aren't texting that are still distracting. And that's all still perfectly legal. So he's looking to push legislation like that, something kind of along the lines of what Florida has and a handful of other states do as well.
So it would be illegal for me to drive down the road with my phone up to my head, essentially.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And that way you couldn't mess with your phone while you're driving as well.
Ah, 10-4. And education priorities the governor's kind of outlined here as well.
Yeah, he has a couple of education priorities, including tackling unfunded mandates through his teacher compensation admission. But the big one that he wants to tackle is the career awareness training requirement that was passed last year. Now, it requires teachers who renew their license through a professional growth point plan to take 15 credit hours of career awareness, which you can do through promoting career navigation for students or learning more about current and future economic needs and how to talk to students about them, or getting hands-on experience through an internship with a company in your area. A lot of teachers pushed back against it, saying, hey, look, we already spend a lot of time on our classrooms. We don't have this additional time to also put toward an unfunded internship as well. And so Holcomb wants to put the onus on school corporations to prioritize career development instead of doing that on teachers. So he wants to make that career requirement entirely optional.
I also think of like early grade teachers who would then, if these weren't made optional, let's say kindergarten teachers would then be required to, I don't know, go to a factory or an office to learn about jobs and then talk to 5-year-olds about it.
Yeah, they even if they're not doing the internship portion of it, they would be talking to 5-year-olds about, you know, what they want to do when they grow up. Which when I was 5, I wanted to be a paleontologist because I was a nerd and did not have friends and wanted to spend time with dinosaurs. So and that plays nothing into what I do now. So that's he's wanting more of a common sense approach to that. And a lot of the legislative leaders who have already talked about this are open to that conversation. And yeah, I mean, he's definitely, even in his comments when he was talking about it, he said that he had a very different perspective than what the state legislature had.
Now, we're going to get to the Indiana State Teachers Association in a little bit, but is this kind of close to what they wanted as well, or did they want them completely off the books?
It's a lot closer than they were, but yeah, no, they ISTA wanted to completely remove that legislation, that they didn't want career awareness to be a requirement. But they do still mostly align with Holcomb on that, at least making it an optional thing and putting the onus more on school corporations, which school corporations already do that for things like bullying or, suicide prevention. A lot of that's already done through the professional development things that school corporations already do.
Okay, so the governor is in this way sort of extending an olive branch to the Indiana State Teachers Association, on this issue at least.
At least in this issue.
Now, there's also the issue of teacher and school funding, which, it gets complicated.
It does, yeah. So, Holcomb has basically said at the beginning of last year that he wanted to make a decision on teacher pay in the next budget session. So this next session that we're talking about is a short session. So they don't talk about the budget. They don't make any changes to the budget during this session unless, extenuating circumstances. And so technically, that's not a conversation for this upcoming session. And so Holcomb has said on a number of occasions, hey, we're going to talk about teacher pay in a directed way in 2021. And the state teachers union says, you know what? No, we can't wait this long. And in fact, the president of the organization, Keith Gamble, said waiting another year without any progress from their perspective is short-sighted. Mm. And so what they're pushing for is actually they want a one-time $75 million push of funding from the budget surplus to go to schools and to go to teachers specifically for teacher funding.
And it is a big budget surplus, and so they're just asking for a tiny piece of it.
Yeah, from their perspective, that's exactly what they're looking for, is that, they just want this chunk to, as an investment, to prove that, hey, you know what, we're not just talking about teacher pay, we are going to be doing something actionable.
Let's talk more about the Indiana State Teachers Association. What do they want with regard to test scores?
Yeah, so they really want to decouple test scores from teacher performance. So in Indiana, student test scores affect both teacher performance grades and school grades. And so in a year like this, when test scores went down across the state, it really highlights some of the concerns this group and groups like them have with that relationship. President Keith Gamble said during a press conference yesterday that having test scores and accountability so fundamentally intertwined doesn't show how a teacher can impact a student. And he used this example talking about getting a student a year and a half forward, but because they aren't passing a test, that teacher is still considered ineffective. Mm. And so that's a lot of where that concern is. And so they want to completely decouple those test scores from those performance grades.
And when we say test scores, of course, we're talking about standardized tests, the iLearn, which, as I understand it, the scores for this year's iLearn came
yes.
back fairly low across the board. And so the teachers do not want to be held responsible, I guess. What was the language that they used? Would they want held harmless?
Yes, held harmless. Mm. And all the legislative leaders in Holcomb as well are all on the same page. They're not going to hold teachers and schools accountable for those test scores this year. But what ISTA and what a few other teacher advocates have talked about, including the state superintendent, is removing that issue from the beginning. Instead of having a year like this where those test scores can so fundamentally, mess up a teacher or a school's accountability grade, just removing that piece from the puzzle entirely.
Okay. And they have also made some commentary on the idea. Did it come from the governor or Brian Bosma about a lot of the school funding issues coming from bloated administrations?
Yes, that was Brian Bosma. He was talking a little bit about some of his session priorities. And he said, the real issue that we need to be talking about is the number of administrators that we have in school districts. And I don't remember the figure exactly, but I believe he said there was something along the lines of a 30% increase in administrative roles in school districts, while there's been a decrease in the amount of teachers for school corporations. And so that was kind of his way of saying, hey, we can meet halfway somewhere along here. And ISTA said that the administrative roles that exist are actually necessary because of the regulations that teachers are dealing with, kind of like the career awareness stuff, as well as standardized testing that some school districts could still absolutely cut back. But that wouldn't help everyone across the board. And that's not, in their words, a real solution for teacher funding.
Let's move to election security. What did we hear this week on that front?
Yeah, so the citizen advocacy group Common Cause Indiana hosted a panel yesterday to highlight some of Indiana's shortcomings in election security. And they pointed to two recent studies where the state ranks in the bottom half of states for election integrity. And so those studies considered, for instance, voter turnout, waiting times at polls, mail-in ballots being rejected, and campaign finance systems. And so they were really concerned over election security. So the type of electronic voting machine in the majority of Indiana counties are direct record machines, or DREs, and they pose a threat to voter confidence because it doesn't have a paper trail. And so a lot of these individual counties are moving in that direction. They're trying to get to the point where everyone has a paper ballot trail. Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson has actually requested more funding to update the machines across the state. She did that for the last legislative session, the last budget writing session. She was only able to secure funding for 10% of voting machines across the state, actually made it into the budget. A congressional report actually estimates that replacing all of Indiana's paperless voting machines would cost about $23 million.
Wow.
And the state's budget surplus, which we talked about a little bit with the teacher pay, is in $2.3 billion in reserves. So there's a lot of concerns about that particular circus.
Okay, we got about a minute left. So let's talk about the 2022 way, the initiative that the Indiana Public Broadcasting is undertaking to engage with our listeners. And we talked about election security this week.
Yeah, we did. We asked everyone what questions they had about election security, and folks really responded. And there were a lot of really interesting questions about, you know, why there isn't a paper trail, or why those election systems are different from county to county to county. And so we are now working on answering some of those questions for you ahead of our 2020 election. So if you would like to join that group, please text us at 73224 and just text elections to that number, and then you can join our club and we can talk and you can get those questions answered by us.
Yas queen. Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer Lauren Chapman, thanks again.
Happy as always to be here.
Up next, details on now defunct Celadon Trucking with reporter Jill Sheridan. We'll hear about the executives that caused the demise of the company, and we'll hear from Pete the Planner, who's offering financial advice to displaced employees. That's coming up. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get to reporter Jill Sheridan for more details on Celadon Trucking ceasing operations this week, I want to tell you about yesterday's show. We examined the HIV disclosure laws of Ohio and Indiana. We heard from Side Effects Public Media reporter Paige Flager, who's based out of WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. She's been following the efforts in that state to modernize those laws. We compared them to those that exist here in Indiana. Turns out they're pretty similar. And we heard from local and national advocates who want the laws repealed or modernized now that the advancements in HIV treatment can make the virus nearly undetectable in some patients. And we also heard about the resources available to the HIV population in Indianapolis through the Damien Center. You can hear that show wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In and look for our blue and black logo. Earlier this week, Indianapolis-based trucking giant Celadon ceased operations following financial fraud perpetrated by two former executives. Here to tell us more is Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Jill Sheridan. Hi, Jill.
Hi.
So can you give us some background on this company? This is one of the biggest trucking companies in the nation.
Yeah.
Or it was.
In the Midwest, for sure. And it was, you know, a real success story for Indianapolis, for central Indiana. This company started by Steve Russell and Len Bennett. They started this company back in 1985 and really built it up from just one customer and to the massive employer and trucking carrier that it was just last week. Russell stepped down in 2012, and he actually passed away in 2016, and that's pretty much when the problem started.
Federal fraud charges came last week, and that then paved the way for this week's demise of the company.
Yeah, so it was on Monday, but last week was when those federal charges were brought against two executives. This is fraud charges, 9 counts of fraud charges. The scam, I guess they're saying, cost shareholders about $60 million. Wire and security fraud, as well as a conspiracy to falsify records. Basically, they hid the losses that were related to the declining trucking fleet itself and a whole mess of other administrative misdoings. So
this was the value of the actual equipment that they had, the trucks.
I think a large part of what they were trying to hide was related to the fleet. Yeah.
And so as a result of this fraud, they filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy?
Chapter 11, instead of Chapter 9. Usually with Chapter 11, it gives a company a chance to reorganize or liquidate. I think in this instance, it's probably obvious that they're be liquidating. But it usually takes a little bit longer for Chapter 11 to come through. This obviously happens very quickly.
Do we know anything about these two former executives who perpetrated this fraud?
Well, their names are William Meek, he's 39, and Bobby Peevler, 40. They're both from Indianapolis. We know they've been with the company for a number of years. And Peevler charged with additional counts of making false statements to the public company's accountants. So they're both facing jail time if they are found guilty.
A lot of trucking companies have gone under this year, but this one was the biggest, right?
It was the biggest, yes, absolutely. And according to CBS, more than 800 trucking companies had gone under this year, and that's a lot, but definitely Celadon being one of the biggest to go under this year.
Do we know the reasons behind the fall of all of these trucking companies?
I think there's a lot of reasons, but again, according to what I read from CBS and a couple of other outlets, insurance costs, rising insurance costs, uncertainty in the carrier business right now. A lot of that uncertainty, I hear, is related to tariffs, to federal tariffs that were put in place this year as well.
And you went to the Celadon headquarters on Monday. What did you see?
I did. It was a rainy day, really terrible out there. And everybody, a lot of people, you know, were parking their trucks, more trucks I heard than, you know, are usually in that space on the east side of Indianapolis. And a lot of people taking all their stuff out of the trucks because, of course, truckers, you know, have a lot of their belongings and microwaves, you know, all kinds of stuff that might be in their trucks. So I heard it was kind of like moving day at the dormitories. So you see a lot of people just making sure that they can clear out and get what they can. And also a lot of recruiters on site, you know, set up with a tent, getting all wet and everything, but out there with the employees of Celadon or the ex-employees.
And what about the drivers that were left stranded after the credit card accounts were frozen and they couldn't get gas to get back?
We heard reports of a lot of drivers that were stranded all across the country. Celadon had more than 2,500 drivers, of course, not all of them based here in Indianapolis, but all over the country. And a lot of these recruiters, other trucking companies, other carriers, support groups on social media, everybody activated really quickly, which I thought was pretty cool to try to get these drivers back to their homes as soon as they can, whether that be from a carrier that was trying to help or from, you know, just a ride that they were able to connect with on social media. But yeah, we heard that, you know, the gas cards were cut off and that effectively, you know, cuts off a driver.
As I understand it, the drivers, as a lot of people feel, are going to be okay because there is a nationwide shortage of truck drivers, so they will be absorbed by the industry pretty quickly. But it's the employees at the headquarters who are most heavily affected here.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, there were recruiters out there that day, drivers coming up and talking to the recruiters. The couple drivers that I talked to weren't really too worried about it, weren't necessarily too surprised either. I think there have been a lot of rumblings going on, and they knew, obviously, after the federal charges were filed that, you know, something might happen. They just didn't expect it so quickly. But the recruiters were out there, you know, on Monday, talking with drivers, able to, you know, get them starting to sign the paperwork so they could, you know, hopefully find a job as soon as possible. But, yeah, I mean, close to 1,000, from what I understand, administrative, mechanics, all those positions as well that were based here. And in the trucking industry, they might be able to, you know, fill some of those gaps as well, because I think the industry is shifting, but it may be a little bit harder for those employees.
I heard that the mayor made some comments earlier this week. What did he say?
The mayor did. I thought it was very interesting. He said, you know, this is, quote, the worst kind of corporate recklessness, with the actions of a few highly paid executives creating tragedy for workers across central Indiana. So that's pretty impactful. And of course, the mayor's office also reaching out to these workers to let them know that there is help here locally. First thing, of course, any worker needs to do is file for unemployment insurance with the Indiana Department of Workforce Development. Also, all employees were encouraged to proactively visit Central Indiana Work One locations so they can help connect with job openings and job opportunities. And another thing that the mayor's office did was let people know they could reach out to a personal finance assistance from Pete the Planner.
Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan, thanks for reporting.
Thank you.
And as she said, Carmel-based financial expert Peter Dunn, better known as Pete the Planner, is offering financial advice to displaced Celadon employees, and he joins us right now. Good afternoon.
Hey, thanks for having me, Matt.
Peter, you took to Twitter on Monday as this news was breaking, offering financial advice to now former and displaced Celadon employees. You set up a special email address, celadon@petetheplanner.com. Have you heard from anybody yet?
We have. The stories are as heartbreaking as I feared they'd be when I sent that tweet. Here's the thing, Matt. Losing your job is never fun. Losing your job around the holidays is even worse. And losing your job because of the leadership of an organization's malfeasance is the triple threat. And this is a really tough, scary time. And based on what we're seeing already, this isn't a normal layoff situation. This is break the glass in case of emergency and slam the panic button. This is as bad as we feared.
What kinds of things are you hearing from these former employees? What are their concerns? Are they getting a last paycheck?
That's still up in the air from what we've seen so far. We've been fortunate to be looped in with Mayor Hogsett's office and some other organizations that are just trying to pick up the pieces here. This isn't our first rodeo in this regard. You know, we helped the mayor when the carrier layoffs happened a couple years back. But again, the situation is different because of the uncertainty. It is our feeling that a lot of the drivers should be able to find reemployment rather quickly. It's the administrative staff, the people at headquarters, that are going to be flooding the job market during the holidays. That's where we're stepping in to make sure that some very natural decisions that people want to make, like, well, I guess we'll just liquidate our 401k to get us through, to make sure they don't do those sorts of things, that they aren't solving temporary problems with permanent solutions.
Yeah, like, I know every case is different, but what's kind of your advice for them and maybe some of the other displaced employees?
What's strange is I actually wrote a column about this about 3 weeks ago in the Indianapolis Business Journal, because, Matt, whether you and I like it or not, it is layoff season. It just is. This is how it is for the last 15 years. While this is not a layoff, this is a, I don't even know what you call it, a catastrophe. Some of the same principles apply. So here's where we like people to start. If you lose your job around the holidays or any time at all. And this one's weird. I don't like to tell people not to panic, because I think that's really not helpful. However, you have to match your level of attention with the gravity of the situation. That is to say, Matt, some people don't get heated enough. Some people don't care enough. They think it's just a blip, while others completely lose their mind. I would say this particular situation is rather serious based on the timing. And so the first thing is to match your emotions with what is going on. Again, sounds not helpful at all, but having helped thousands of people through this before, we know here that making sure the person understands what is really going on is the first step.
This is a perfect example of what can happen when there's dubious management at the top, which unfortunately isn't anything new. Anyone with a normal 9-to-5 could be a victim of this. And as we've seen in this case, it can happen in an instant. What can people do now to prevent personal financial disaster if their employer goes belly up?
Well, you know, here's what I don't know about. It sounds like I'm not going to answer your brilliant question, Matt, but I assure you it's coming. We don't know yet with Celadon whether people had company stock within their 401ks, right? And as you know, you think about some of the big crashes of all time, WorldCom and the energy company out of Houston that I can't think about right
Enron,
now.
Yeah.
There it is. What was so troublesome is that people had their personal wealth tied up with their employment in the sense that their 401k had company stock in it. So one of the best things you can do is be very sensitive to the level of company stock, if you're a publicly traded company, that you have tied to your future. We don't like to see any more than 10% of your 401k tied up in company stock. And even in some cases, Matt, that's a little aggressive. So I'm very frankly, and again, we're still covering some of this stuff. I hope that's not what we see. I hope that people weren't convinced by management to invest in your future, invest in your organization by buying the stock. I don't know. I'm just saying that is my biggest fear with this.
What about simpler tools like emergency funds and things like that? Things that are that make a lot of sense, but are all too absent from many people's financial life.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, though, I was in Jacksonville a couple weeks ago at a conference, and I heard a person from a very large financial firm say, everyone needs 3 months' expenses. That's for married couples. And single parents need 6 months' expenses set to the side. And while, Matt, that is true, come on, that's not even realistic. Where is this single parent going to come up with the wherewithal and the margin to come up with 6 months' expenses? And so, yes, the advice is obviously have an emergency fund, but that's easier said than done. And so in these situations, as listeners are saying, well, how can I prevent this from happening? Yes, have an emergency fund. But for a person that it happens to, it's what do you do now? Frankly, you print off your bank statement and you grab a marker and you start saying, all right, what needs to change? What habit, what daily trip to, you know, this store or this restaurant, what needs to change so I can know the minimum amount of money that I need to earn over the next 30 days to make ends meet? And that's what gets you through. It's that this is terrible. I need to acknowledge it's terrible. And I need to make behavioral decisions now by cutting expenses, not by robbing my 401k, not by a personal loan, and even not by calling a relative and saying, can you help me out? You have to make sure that you've beaten the bushes thoroughly in terms of your expenses before you attack the income side of this problem.
What should people who are hearing this try to avoid when it comes to planning for potential unemployment? Are there financial products or services that are out there that are, I don't know, a little more predatory than they are helpful to consumers?
I always choose my words carefully here because I don't want to have to take a call from my attorney, but because it costs me something. Payday loans are the perfect example and probably what you're getting at. We do not want someone to go to a strip mall to solve their financial problems. No offense, strip mall, you inanimate object to you. No offense, but we don't want someone to go to a strip mall and say, hey, I'm not going to get paid. Can you front me some money? That's the worst possible thing you could do. In some cases, you're looking at 1,000% interest rates. And I wish I was making up that number to get an effect, but that's the actual interest rate. So, there are predatory situations like that. Truthfully, when I went to Twitter and said, hey, if you have questions, email us, celadon@pizzaplanner.com. I did it knowing that we don't even have anything to sell these people, right? And I also know other people are going to attempt to serve these people out of the goodness of their heart. And we're thankful because it takes a village. But there are also predatory people. They're going to say, let us help you. Let us help you liquidate your 401k. Let us help you do these sorts of things that are bad. So, we've had people take us up on it. Also, we've worked with the mayor's office on this sort of stuff before. And this is a weird little sweet spot for us, finding people that found themselves without a job and helping them put together a reasonable strategy to bridge the gap between the next income opportunity.
Finally, when this sort of thing happens, you know, people at the top doing bad things that bring down a company, we hear about people losing faith in institutions. How does it make you feel, and how can people stay positive?
It is frustrating. It's hurtful. You know, I live in the Midwest. I live in Indiana, central Indiana, for a reason. I like the sensibility of the people around here. And the sad thing is these folks that did this were homegrown people. And so it's hurtful. All I can say is this: other business leaders that have read this story, who've listened to this conversation, take note, do right by your people, and set a culture of transparency. And, you know, if you want to be the part of the solution, then be part of the solution, you know. And I guess that's my pointless yet emotional final plea.
Carmel-based financial expert Peter Dunn, Pete the Planner, thanks for what you're doing and thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, dockless scooters. Are they in your city yet? They're a fun way to get around, but emergency rooms are seeing a number of scooter-specific injuries in cities where they can be found. We'll talk to an expert in diagnostic radiology with the IU School of Medicine who took it upon herself to conduct a study of these injuries. How are people being hurt while riding electric scooters? And like I said, they're fun to ride, but how can we avoid some of those common injuries if we can't bear to give them up? That's next. And if you're looking for a dramatic tale to spice up your weekend, I'd encourage you to check out Wednesday's show from this week, the story of a Portland, Indiana native who was the victim of identity theft starting as a child, and it continued for two decades thereafter. She's now a PhD and assistant professor at South Dakota State University. She has a memoir out about her experience. When she found out who was behind it, well, I'll let you take it from here. You can find that on our podcast feed, wherever you get podcasts. Again, that was Wednesday's show from this week. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in a moment. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. If you live in an urban area or near a college campus, odds are that electric scooters are a familiar sight these days. Although people might be becoming more familiar with electric scooters, it doesn't necessarily mean that we have all mastered how to safely ride them yet. And researchers suggest that more education around proper use of these scooters is still necessary. Joining us today is Dr. Aiza Ashraf, an expert in diagnostic radiology at the Indiana University School of Medicine, here to talk about new findings from a study that took a look at motorized scooter injuries. Dr. Ashraf, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I feel like e-scooters are a phenomenon that appeared overnight. And I think in a lot of cases that's literal. It felt very much like one day we didn't have them and then one day they were everywhere. When did e-scooters first come to your attention?
So Indiana first saw the release of these e-scooters in June of 2018. The first kind of just popped up, just like you mentioned, on the scene. And then a couple weeks later, the second brand of scooters came to Indianapolis. And we really didn't have any policy to deal with what to do with these scooters. So the Indiana state kind of asked for these companies to, you know, halt all their activities so that they can come up with some sort of regulation or some sort of policy in place to deal with them. And both companies were like, no, we're not going to stop our activities, but we're happy to be cooperative in any way that we can. So by August of 2018 is when the state kind of came up with their own state recommendations for both the scooter riders as well as the companies who are making these scooters. And those included things like they had to give numbers, serial numbers, usage information from the company. The companies each had to have their own liability insurance for scooters as well as have a 24-hour hotline. And for the riders, those things included they had to have a driver's license as well as they were kind of encouraged to use safety equipment such as a helmet, but they were not required to do so. And then also people who ride scooters were meant to ride on the streets with the flow of traffic and not actually on sidewalks. But again, these things are not really well enforced at this point at all. And you often see people riding on the sidewalks rather than on the streets like they should. You never see helmets or any sort of safety wear if you actually see these. And they're driven in places like the Cultural Trail and the Greenways, which they're not supposed to be driven on either. So clearly it's there's certainly some policies out there, but they're not really well enforced.
And your focus and the reason you're with us today is kind of to take a look at the injury statistics and things like this. So if you don't quite know the answer to this, you'll forgive me. But how do Indianapolis's rules or Indiana's rules compare to that of, say, other cities or other states? Is everybody kind of enacting the same kind of a policy?
Well, I think region-wise, it's different. But for us, we're pretty welcoming to scooters. Actually, in the next year, we're planning to have up to 1,000 more of these electric scooters come to our city. Versus if you look kind of nationally, there's kind of mixed feelings about these scooters. After a scooter-related fatality in the city of Nashville, the mayor actually wanted to halt all scooters in the city. And when it came to a vote, that actually failed. So Nashville does still have electric scooters. But there was a push at one point for them to actually ban electric scooters because of that fatality.
As a radiologist, did you see an increase in patients affected by e-scooters?
Absolutely. So I was actually on the emergency radiology rotation at the time when this first started to be a thing. So October of 2018 was kind of when we really start to see a ramp up in scooter-related injuries. And it felt like back-to-back, every single night I was on, there was another scooter-related injury where they're requesting an X-ray or a CT in the ER. So I just noticed it on my own, like, wow, there's a lot more scooter-related accidents than I was expecting to see. And that kind of started off this question that, you know, is this abnormal? Like, is this the trend that's been happening, or is this something new? And that's kind of the inspiration for why we dug into, you know, what the trends have been since 2013 to now. And that's where we came up with this data.
And what exactly was the goal of the study that you conducted?
So we wanted to see how the electric scooters, the kind of the time frame of when they were released, if that affected the scooter-related injuries in terms of the exams that we saw in radiology since before and after the release of those scooters. We wanted to see if putting it on a timeline showed that there was an actual increase.
How easy was it to gather all of the data? I mean, you're talking about medical data keeping, which is pretty precise. Mm-hmm. And was it just a matter of going in and looking at, oh, this is under this category and this category?
So you would think that with an electric medical record, it would be super easy. But that was actually the most time. It took so much time for us to try and do, because each time we had basically what we did was we used our RIS, our radiology informatics systems. And what we do is from our RIS, we queried scooter injury. And from there, all of the cases of a scooter or with the keyword scooter in the indication for a study came up on a list. Then we had to one by one go through every single one of those. So that was 351 in the year 2018 alone. We had to go into the electric chart, the medical record for each of the patients, and find what kind of scooter. So over 200 of these were scooter not otherwise specified, right? So we did not know for sure that those were definitely electric scooters. So of all of the 351 studies that were included, only 69 could definitively be linked. So that could be from the report from the ambulance. That could be from the report from the resident who was in the emergency room at the time. So there was just one note which said it was an electric scooter, and that was what linked it. But the huge limitation in our study was that there was just not good enough documentation in the EMR for us to link all of these studies, all of these exams, to electric scooters.
And what was the scope of the study? Are we looking just at Indianapolis, or was it a wider range?
So we were looking at IU health exams. So IU is across the whole state, basically. But the two cities in Indiana which we have electric scooters are Bloomington. So the campus of IU has scooters everywhere. And then the city of Indianapolis. So primarily it would be like Methodist, Eskenazi, as well as the IU Bloomington campus for the hospitals.
What kind of injuries were the most common that you saw?
So we found the most common injury to be a distal radial fracture. So that is a bone in your distal wrist. And that was 6 out of our 36 patients had those.
So wrist injuries.
Yes. Yeah.
And you looked at the amount of exams ordered for scooter-related injuries over mm-hmm. a five-year period. And Was there a particular age range most affected by these injuries?
Yeah, we found that most of our patients that were positive were in that age range of 18 to 30.
And what is it that causes injuries on e-scooters? Are they just challenging to ride? Are they too fast? How are people typically being injured? What's happening?
So while some of the cases did have fall from scooter as the indication, because there's a lot of limitation in terms of what was in the medical record, we don't have an exact mechanism of action for injury for all of our cases. But I will say fall from scooter with outstretched hands was probably one of the most common mechanisms of injury that were documented.
We're seeing a lot of wrist injuries. What other kinds of injuries are we seeing more often than, say, others?
So another really common injury that we saw was a soft tissue contusion. So say you fell and you bumped your head and you got a little bit of a bruise. On X-ray or on CT, sometimes you can actually see that bruising with our imaging. So that was the second most common. And then after that, we saw distal clavicular fractures as well. So kind of in the shoulder area.
Collarbone.
Yes, exactly.
Hmm. And I think of riding a bike, and there can be a potential injury there as well. What makes the risks of, say, riding a bike different from that of just hopping on an e-scooter?
So, yeah, the first time you ride a bike, you do expect to fall off maybe the first couple times. You have someone who teaches you how to use the bike, and there's usually a little bit of training wheels involved. Versus here you have an app that lets you sign in. You get on the scooter, and there's really no other instruction. You just kind of go. So I think that people who aren't familiar with the use of this device are definitely at risk of falling because they don't necessarily know what they're doing. There's no training like with if you ride a motorcycle or drive a car. All of those things are highly regulated. You have to get licensed in order to ride them because we know that there's dangers associated with a new driver getting on the road. There's dangers to that driver and dangers for the other pedestrians who are on the street. So this is just something that there's no training involved, and there's also really very minimal regulation.
And I feel like it's more normal to be seen wearing a helmet on a bike than, say, an electric scooter, which is not at all a traditional mode of transportation. And so I think that there's a hesitancy to wear helmets, but they really are recommended, right?
Yes. Yeah. The apps themselves do recommend these safety precautions. But again, they're not enforced and they're not required. So you are much more likely to see somebody on a bicycle wearing a helmet than you are one of these electric scooters.
And the study highlights the importance of more public education around scooters. What is it that people need to know before they jump on one to keep themselves safe?
So I think one of the most important things is to just use your basic safety precautions. Don't get on an electric scooter if you're inebriated. It's not safe for you or other pedestrians. And then also, these wrist fractures, they're a real danger. So if you have wrist guards or you have protective gears like helmets and you do want to use the electric scooters, use those safety precautions before getting on.
My wife got a free helmet from Bird, one of the big e-scooter companies. Some companies have also tried to implement these sort of incentive programs for safety gear, where if you submit a photo of yourself wearing a helmet on the scooter, you can receive future ride credits. Do you think the responsibility lies here? Where do you think the responsibility lies to make sure riders are safe? The companies, the cities, or the riders?
I think it's a combination of all of those things. So riders should be aware that there are dangers associated with the scooters and that to protect themselves, they should try and wear these safety helmets and wrist guards if they can. But then also I think that the companies need to be very aware about this danger and try and provide for those people that ride their scooters. And then the state, if there's a known danger to the residents, we should come up with policies in order to best protect the residents. So I think that now that we know that there are dangers associated with these electric scooters, maybe we can regulate them a little bit better to make sure that people who are riding them are safe.
And again, you looked at injuries, but you know a little bit more. So again, forgive me if you can't answer this question, but are the companies protected from liability in, say, the agreement that you check off or hit when you agree to download the app and start an account with these companies?
So there is a lot of fine print with each of the apps. But in terms of liability, the companies themselves are responsible, because obviously with these, no one gets insurance like they do for a car or a motorcycle with their own insurance. The liability goes with the electric scooter companies.
And some of the companies also cite infrastructure as a place where we could improve the safety of scooter riders. Bike lanes are considered the ideal spot to ride scooters around town. And in Indianapolis here, there are a lot of bike lanes rather than sidewalks or even trails. Like you said, sidewalks are out, but a lot of people use them. I see it every day. How much do you feel infrastructure factors into the safety conversation?
I think it's such a new device that people just don't know where, even though it says in the app you're not supposed to ride them on the sidewalks, because that's what people see others doing. That's where they're going. So I absolutely think that, you know, better instruction by the app, better kind of guidelines from our policy would help a lot in terms of making sure that riders are riding in the safest way, because sidewalks are not the safest way. And I agree. I think bike lanes are definitely a reasonable way for riders to go about riding these scooters, and that they should still follow the traffic laws as bike lanes do typically as well. So,
and your study also suggests that communities consider implementing speed limits on scooters. What would you recommend an appropriate speed limit be?
So as of right now, the electric scooters in Indianapolis aren't supposed to accelerate past 15 miles per hour. But say you're on a hill and you're going downhill, that can increase your speed to greater than that 15 mile per hour limit. And the current literature on trauma shows that, you know, at higher speeds, injuries can be more devastating. So we do have some limits in terms of speed right now, but I think it could be better regulated. And with that kind of acceleration that you do expect on a downhill, I think that that can be actually broken. It can definitely go faster than that 15 mile per hour acceleration that it's supposed to be stuck at.
What more research would you like to see done on this topic?
So I think one of our major limitations, like I had mentioned earlier, was just that we don't have enough documentation within the electronic medical records that definitively link each of these exams to an electric scooter. So if the colleagues that we have in the emergency room were to kind of specify in their own charting that, you know, this was an electric scooter rather than just say scooter injury, we could make more of a definitive link to more serious injuries that have occurred, not just distal radial fractures. So that's one area. But then also, we only looked within our municipality. We looked in Indianapolis and Bloomington. We didn't do a nationwide study. But in the future, I think multi-center studies would be a much better idea, give us a much better idea of what's going on a national framework. So we could have better policy that could be national in terms of how to deal with these scooters and how to safely use them.
I don't mean for you to out your colleagues or anything like that, but there are differences in how physicians keep their records. I would imagine, especially in the emergency room, which is sort of a hectic environment, how do you communicate that you want physicians to sort of make this note?
Right. I totally agree. The ER is one of the busiest places in the hospital. But even something as simple as putting an E dash before they say scooter injury would let us classify it as an electric scooter.
And research on these e-scooters is important because it could help inform the policy around the mode of transportation. And this one's relatively new. What policy recommendations would you most like to see policymakers consider moving forward to curb these injury rates?
So I think safety precautions such as helmets would be huge.
Requiring
rather than just recommending. And then I think that better limitations in terms of how people are riding these scooters. So too often we see these on the sidewalks, and we see pedestrians in getting hit by these scooters as well. We see inebriated riders riding the scooters and falling and injuring themselves. So just like you can be bicyclist under the influence, I think that we just need to enforce the current policies better.
Dr. Aiza Ashraf, thanks again for making the time to join us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross and Chris Flood. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get podcasts so you always know if we're talking about something that's up your alley. We're back on Monday to talk about a new investigative report on a mind-reading tool used by police in some cities, including Elkhart. And we'll find out why some Indiana universities may be going test optional on the ACT and SAT admission tests. That's next time. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.